Flip the Focus is proudly brought to you by Hotwire Australia, making tech irresistible through marketing, PR, and comms. Welcome back to Flip the Focus, the show that tells unexpected tales of tech. I'm Jen Dobby, and producer Nico is here as always.
Thank you. I'm still here in the background.
Not so much in the background someday.
Yeah.
So this episode, we're talking to Carissa Bream, more commonly known as KB. And KB and I get into one of the biggest challenges being taken on by tech right now, and that's storytelling in the media. So we're discussing whether traditional media is in fact dead, killed off by socials and the decreasing attention span of the population, or is it more accurate to say that the channels really need to change to keep up? And we really get into quite some detail across AI and what role that tech plays, particularly AI, in leading the way in the change by bringing more stories to more people in much more interesting ways.
One of the things that stood out to me in this episode was that KB mentioned that traditional media has been stuck in their ways. And we've now been in the social media era for the last 15 years. So at some stage, that model will have to change.
Yeah, look, I absolutely agree. I think it's a really valid point. And KB is incredibly switched on. She's very fast-paced and ambitious. But at the same time, I found she had deeply held, quite traditional values. And you really get the feeling straight away of someone with a huge heart, which I think you're all going to find fascinating.
Oh, I will say one more thing just before we get going, and that is that KB's work ethic is absolutely admirable. Where a lot of startup owners at Christmas would want to take a break and go and let their hair down, KB is quite the opposite. And the thing is, if she has to put something out on Christmas Eve or if she has to record something on Christmas Eve, I think she'll do it.
She's unapologetic about eating traditional media for lunch. She is unashamed of her ambition, unafraid of hard work, and she's absolutely uncompromising on her moral code. Look, as Nico said, she's out there. She's creating a new normal. Today's guest is something of an unstoppable force. Carissa Bream, more commonly known as KB, is a serial entrepreneur and founder of KBI Media, an independent global cybersecurity media company. She doesn't stop there, though. She's a LinkedIn top voice in tech. She serves as head of cybersecurity journalism at KBI Media, where she focuses on developing the platform into a leading hub for cybersecurity news and updates. Carissa helps tech startups and established companies effectively communicate their narratives. And alongside that, and one of the reasons I was so keen to get her on to talk to us today, is that she is also the host of their flagship podcast, which is the KB Cast. And I think I would like to start today, KB, by saying massive congratulations on your 300th deep dive episode of the KB Cast. That is amazing.
Yeah, well, thanks, Jen. Thanks for having me. Good to be on the other side. Thanks for having me on your show.
You're very welcome. I want to take a minute to ask you a question about those 300 episodes. What would be either a guest or maybe a theme that really stands out for you if you have a think back over those episodes?
I would say, as a rule of thumb, all of my guests have been amazing. The fact that some of these really senior, capable, high-caliber people are taking time out of their day to come and talk to me at length, mind you, on the show and to provide insight is amazing. So I've interviewed some people once, some people two, three times now, and it's really good because you start to build that relationship with the person. Even if you only interview them once a year, it's sort of like the next time you interview them, feels like not a lot of time has passed. So I would say that I'm liking the event coverage stuff that we're doing. You know, you're sort of up and close and personal with the event. It's giving a little bit of insight into how that event was running and what were the key points, because as you know, there's so many events happening all over the world and you can't possibly go to all of them. So if we can sort of provide a little bit of insight around what was covered, I think people think they don't need to be there to really get the gist of what's happening. So for me, I don't want to name anything or any particular angle, but I would say, though, AI is still a massive thing. We don't have all the answers, and it's great to just get in there and ask the tough questions and ask the right questions that I think perhaps mainstream media aren't covering to get people answers. And it's still going to be a little bit of a Tetris game, but the more people we can speak to and hear their thoughts and opinions, the more that we can actually disseminate that information out to people who may be able to take one key thing away from those interviews.
Yeah, you're right. I love that. There's a bit to unpack there, but I've also been enjoying, engaging with that content as well. I think to talk to your events content, It's an excellent scope. You know, it's a storytelling trope, which we're used to seeing in kind of consumer and also in user-generated content. So, you know, why not have it in this B2B space? And I've really enjoyed seeing, I think particularly in some of your content lately, it's so lovely to see how passionate people are, both attendees, but also the organizers of the events as well. And that really helps bring it to life and give it that warmth that's often missing in that business conversation.
Yeah, I think so. And I would also say as well that last year we were the first in country to do the news desk style interviews that we've been running in collaboration with Microsoft. It was the first time I've ever done something like that. A big player like that has come in and said, all right, let's do it. I also think even on the day, it gives a bit of a dimension to the event as well. It gives people something to do, look at. It's a bit different, a bit unique. And I think as well that it also shines a light on some of these executives that are doing really, really great work that probably don't get as much of the media attention in the mainstream stuff because it's just not what they cover. So we've really found our own sort of specialization and niche, and you know, we're covering things at all different angles around cybersecurity as well. So I think that it's just been a natural organic evolution, and I am very passionate about it because the industry needs it, but equally, you know, I've come from this background historically and it was just so dry, and I wanted to sort of bring a level of modernity to the space, which I believe was missing historically.
Yeah, I think you're right. And you and I have spoken about that before. One of the things I love, which we have you on record saying, is, you know, media is not dying. The formats of media are dying. And I think this really plays into that. Talk to us a little bit about that distinction between, you know, media itself as the big vertical and the formats within it, and what you think the movements are there, and what you're doing to keep it alive.
I love this question, Jen, and it's something that I often think about. I mean, look, I would say, as you know, if you look traditionally, there's been newspapers and, you know, broadcasters, etc. There definitely will be a decline, and there has been a decline in newspapers. That's first and foremost. I think, you know, broadcasts will still be there, like, you know, your Channel 7 and news stations. I mean, they do 12, 24-hour news cycles. They're going to be covering, I don't know, there was a random wild bear spotted somewhere in Sydney Zoo that was out, you know, doing something. Those are the sort of stories that those news companies and stations are covering, right? And then we sort of move on. But then the other side of it has been that you've had your typical, the Australian, Fin Review, et cetera. They cover such a broad suite of different elements. Part of that, yes, is tech and security, but they really cover it at the high level. High level meaning so-and-so got funded, so-and-so IPO'd, so-and-so company had a data breach. And then that's probably the be-all, end-all. But then, you know, in industries like mine, there's a lot going on every day. There's a lot of detail you have to get through. So I think that the need for trade media has been more relevant than ever. What I will caveat that with saying is the form of the media is changing because it's the way in which the consumer behavior has changed. That's the part that I don't know if all trade and media outlets are really understanding. So you mentioned before your daughter is looking at the Vox Pop interviews that I've done. Your daughter's a great example because that is how media outlets really need to be approaching. Well, how do we target the younger generation? Now, media will sit back and go, oh, I can't believe that YouTuber and content creator is doing that. The chances are you look at people like Mr. Beast, like they, you know, he's worth $1 billion+, right? So this guy would give a run for major media outlets that exist out there. So I think that perhaps traditional outlets need to really take a, you know, page out of people like, you know, Mr. Beast and all these other content creators that exist on TikTok, and that they are doing something right. And I think the game's really, really changing. So when I say that it's definitely not dying, just the focus and the mediums are changing. So now there's an opportunity for players like ours and others out there to really shift with it. And I think people need to get it out of their head that, oh, this is the way we did it 20 years ago. It doesn't matter. This is the way the market's moving. This is where the consumers are that you're trying to target in order to get those advertising dollars through the door. So I think that now if people aren't moving towards that model, they will become obsolete.
Yeah, I think it's a really valid conversation. And we you know, we talk about like overturning that traditional order. And I think what's interesting in the conversation now for the media is to look at, if we zoom out from that and we look at what's that broader storytelling capability, a great story is still a great story. So really it's about thinking about the narrative that lives in a channel agnostic way or a format agnostic way. And then exactly to your point, okay, what are the best ways that we can get this out to consumers? And it may be, you know, as you've proven and we've talked about it a bit today, but it might be in those, you know, 3 minute or 30 second clips. It might be on Instagram. It might be via, you know, stories in traditional press or online publications. It's really, again, about thinking about how people are going to consume. And I think if we look at everything from kind of linear television down, right, if you look at like massive broadcasters across the world, they're certainly considering how they bring entertainment stories to life. The way that people consume everything is changing. And, you know, we started talking earlier on in this conversation about looking at different types of storytelling, like B2B storytelling, as opposed to consumer or user-generated storytelling. Really, I think that more modern conversation is around, look, a story is a story, you know, and traditionally it's been, oh, there is a way to tell a story that's a business story, because it all to me wraps up in this societal perception of, you know, you're a different person at work than you are at home. Whereas now we know, you know, the C-suite are doom scrolling with the rest of us. You know, this is the media has to catch up with that and has to create and disseminate stories in that same way.
Yeah, and this is where I think it's interesting, Jen, because the part that I still don't understand is people are still hung up on, to your point, this is the way we've always told the stories in this sort of formula, this sort of medium. I think if people can get past that, then they're going to be in a great position. So that's the part that I'm sort of struggling and grappling with. Perhaps I don't come from a traditional media background. So for me, maybe I just saw a gap and I filled it. I also didn't kind of wake up with everything I'm doing now. It's been a natural progression. The other thing is the Pew Research Center sort of came out with a report and a little bit of insights at the tail end of last year. And they're sort of claiming that about 1 in 5 US adults say that they regularly get their news from influencers on social media. So again, what companies need to focus on is social media, their endpoints. So we obviously have our platform, KBI Media. We get the content, we package it up in various ways for people to get their eyes on that look visually appealing, as well as they get the headline then as well. Most people only like to read headlines or they skim over it. Yes, you're going to get people who read the whole article. But again, I'm always of the theory, strokes different folks. Some people are going to like podcasts. Others are going to like short form video. As a media company, or as a modern media company more specifically, to stay relevant in this game, we need to be targeting people on various platforms and various formats as well. So I think that, again, the stats are there. This is how people are waking up in the morning. They're going on social media. And if you can get your message and your story, to your point earlier, out there, the way in which people want to consume it, you're going to be winning.
Yeah, I think you're exactly right. What role do you see AI playing in that dissemination and in that storytelling, KB?
So in 2022, when ChatGPT came out in sort of a more ubiquitous sort of manner and people started jumping on the bandwagon, that was probably when I started to see a massive dislodgement with your more traditional players. So what I've noticed as well, I'll just give the context, would be that now that people aren't having as much weight against written content like they used to, and that is fact. So weight now is being driven from podcasts like this, being driven from vertical videos, video content, YouTube, etc., even sort of, you know, social images and carousels that people can understand at all, you know, quickly what it is, the story that they're telling. So I would say by that coming into play, it has meant that has left other outlets scrambling a little bit on what they're going to do. Now, the other side of that would be, well, there's a lot more crappier content being produced, which I can see from a mile off that I can tell by the AI syntax. But I also think that it's meant that it's leveled out the playing field. It's created opportunities for younger and newer and more modern players like us to potentially get ahead and start to, you know, own that space. So I do see it as an advantage. Other people out there would disagree with me on that fact, but purely from our perspective, it's meant that it's sort of, you know, weakened the positions of the other players.
Yeah, look, I think it's a fascinating conversation. For me, it's analogous with when we started looking at companies, for example, like Canva, and a lot of the conversation was around, you know, is Canva sort of destroying design as an art form, as a craft? I absolutely don't think that it is. I think it's about, you know, the democratization of that ability to design, if we talk about Canva specifically. And I think in this context, AI is performing a similar role. There's always going to be, you know, there always has been shitty content and there always will be shitty content. There's always also going to be excellent content. And, you know, back to our earlier conversation, if you have a great story with great bones and it's well researched and it's put together by a knowledgeable expert, you know, bringing AI into the dissemination of that can be a huge advantage. I think it's got to be about that use of human intelligence in terms of how you deploy it and where you deploy it, and just making sure that AI is enhancing, you know, rather than taking over that production.
Absolutely. And so many people are like, oh, but there's so much content out there. But to your point, like, people are going to see lots of content, but they're going to know pretty, you know, quickly, hey, that's pretty shit versus, hey, that's pretty good. People know, and they're going to gravitate towards brands and outlets that are producing good content, that are not being lazy about it, that are evolving what they're doing as well. We can't just sit there and we're going to rest on our laurels and think that it's enough to carry it forward. We are now at a point in time where you could literally come from nowhere and you could be like one of the main players. That's what excites me about the work that we're doing, especially, you know, me driving at the coalface. But equally, it means that, you know, other players, you can't just sit around and just expect that the same sort of outcome that you had before is going to stay the same. So I think that for me, I'm going to be really intrigued to see what happens. And I'm always about, how can we be better each day? What is happening out there? I look at all forms of content to see, is there something in it that we could take, that we could start to embed into the content that we're doing, to make an industry that can, to some people's point, think is quite banal, interesting and intriguing, to get that message out there. I'm not sitting there doing cosmetics and, you know, necessarily fun things. I'm working in quite a dry industry. So it's even made it even more challenging to make this space relevant, to make it modern, to make it sexy, and to make it to a level that people are going to want to listen to it anyway.
And I think that's it. I think that's, you know, you've exactly hit the nail on the head there, because, you know, cybersecurity, the industry within which you specialize, absolutely, it's got a number of things standing against it. It can be a complex thing to understand. It isn't traditionally seen as a sexy thing to understand. But, you know, inherently and particularly as we move forward, it's absolutely an essential thing for people to be aware of and to understand. And I completely agree. If we can start, you know, the more ways that we can find to break down concepts and industries like cybersecurity that are inherently very complex and make them digestible and understandable and interesting, the better that has got to be, because it's certainly something that people across all types of business need to understand. And I think, look, that's probably a great jumping off point for us to start having that conversation within AI and its role in cybersecurity. We've talked a bit about the role of AI in reshaping media. I'd be really interested to hear your take on what you think AI is having a role in terms of its reshaping of the cybersecurity landscape. You mentioned, for example, that, you know, it's this new world we're writing the framework for. So how do you see AI reshaping cybersecurity? And to your point about, you know, remaining positive about that, what opportunities do you see it presenting for professionals within cybersecurity?
Yeah, this is interesting. And I think that depending on who you ask that question to, you're going to get various answers. So to start at the top, I think that mainstream media are positioning it as doom and gloom. And the reason why I would say that is sometimes when I go outside of my immediate security technology bubble and I'm meeting other people, that's typically when they go, oh, you're in that industry. Do you think it's, you know, doom and gloom and it's going to be like the Terminator? So I think that that's a separate problem to address. But I would think that there is this stigma that that is the reality. Now, if I look back through history, when you've got back in the day, you'd have candle, you know, stick makers and people that would do like blacksmith. Then Thomas Edison came around and created the light bulb, electricity, which, you know, obviously people still burn candles today, but not in the same sort of way. Those roles are redundant. Now, even before the internet started, and there was no Google or any of that type of stuff around. So those people that are working in Google and Facebook and, sorry, Meta, they had to work somewhere else historically, right? So retrospect is a wonderful thing to have, because when we're looking back now, we can be like, oh, it was a great thing. It's created other jobs. The difficult thing is when we're already in it and we don't have all of the answers. Like, no one really does have all the answers if we were to do a lot of reporting and insights across the world. There are some, but as you said, we're sort of etching our way forwards in this space. So I think that it's still early days. It is a good thing because it means that people can focus on, if you go to uni for 7 years to become a doctor, and then when you became a doctor, you're spending a lot of time doing menial and trivial tasks. It means that it's actually taking away from the 7+ years that you've dedicated your life and your soul to actually help patients. So the point about AI is that it can actually help leverage a lot of that monotonous task and get you as a medical practitioner to actually leverage your critical thinking capability to actually be a doctor, not to be a doctor and do paperwork in the background. So I think that there's a lot of misconceptions about artificial intelligence out there. But again, it's, you know, there's shows like this one and ours that exist out there to sort of correct perhaps some of the false narratives that seem to be the common fodder amongst consumers on social media.
Yeah, and I think, you know, as usual with things that we don't necessarily understand, a lot of it is fear-based, you know, the kind of aggression or reticence that people have towards AI. I think it's interesting, you know, you used the analogy there, the example there of a medical doctor. I think if you're talking in that cybersecurity space, it's actually not dissimilar. They are essential jobs and they are things that really are incredibly important. Is cybersecurity life and death? Sometimes yes, largely no. But certainly we want our cybersecurity experts to be concentrating on those bigger questions. How are we, you know, at the same time that all AI's capabilities are evolving in terms of removing the monotony of day-to-day, also its nefarious capabilities are improving, right? So we really want our cybersecurity experts to be able to use the best of AI to keep them on top of thinking about the big picture and keep the rest of us safe, you know, both from a broader concept in terms of at government level, but also in day to day in terms of the brands within which we interact.
Exactly. And I think just to go down the security example a little bit more would be, I was a reporting analyst historically. So if I had the capability that's sort of around today, I would have been able to perform my job better. I used to have to manually, literally go up to people's desk, which wasn't even that long ago, like 10 years ago, to say, hey, Jen, do you have the stats that I need to include in the report that I'm making? I mean, I would often have executives roll up to my desk and ask me questions about sort of this, the posture of the security function within the company I was working for. I mean, if I could just run my report through AI and just give me a bit of a summary, that would reduce a lot of the backwards and forwardsing that I had to do, as well as someone constantly coming over to me to ask me a question. So on that front, yeah, it's getting me to focus on the tasks that do require critical thinking and more strategic. But again, if you're doing real rudimentary tasks, then it's sort of taking away from the more skilled stuff that I should be focusing on, which is what people are getting remunerated for, right? So again, it's not to be, it's going to replace, it's going to help us do things in terms of a tool, but you're still going to need oversight. It's still going to make mistakes. You're still going to need someone to look at it and go, oh, does that make sense? Well, maybe not. It's just going to help us do 80% of the heavy lifting. So I see that as a benefit and not sort of a detractor that others may think.
Yeah, I think I'm with you on that. And, you know, from my perspective, some of the conversation that I'm finding frustrating, I think, you know, from some sources within the AI conversation is, you know, okay, well, it's coming for our jobs. So it's almost as though people's mental capacity shuts down at that point. Like, it's coming for our jobs. So end of conversation. Whereas I think what's much more interesting is, exactly to your point, it's going to evolve some jobs. Certainly it is going to supplant some jobs, but it will create other jobs. And the fundamental thing which gets glossed over so often and which you just mentioned yourself is AI still requires human input and human correction and human creativity and empathy. And we are still at this point very much the trainers of AI. So it's really interesting that, you know, we're starting to see from some quarters sort of the throwing of the hands in the air and, you know, from an industrial revolution perspective, you know, it's kind of game over and all our jobs will become obsolete. No, not the case. It's a time of evolution, and it's an exciting time, I think.
So that we have to evolve as a society or else we're not going to move forward. So this was the inevitable. It was going to happen. There's always going to be people that are reserved, that are, you know, cautious about it. It's like everything, though. Look at when cloud computing came out. People were like, oh, that's never going to be a thing. There was even extracts from newspapers that had the internet was not going to be a thing. The internet completely crippled newspapers. So I think that people are naive in thinking that, you know, well, I don't want AI to be here. Well, it's here. It doesn't care about your feelings towards it.
It's not new. It's been around a really long time. Yes, the speed at which it's operating and iterating is certainly new. I think it's around just getting on board with it and remaining curious to make sure that, you know, we're really making the most of it in terms of storytelling capabilities and effectiveness. And also, you know, from a creative standpoint as well, making sure that the human side of the text still comes out, that there's still that empathy and creativity. In fact, speaking of which, KB, we've talked before, and something I found really interesting, one of the reasons I wanted to talk to you in more depth today, is when we first met, you said a really interesting thing, which is that everyone's got an idea, but really you're interested in execution. And that's been kind of playing around in my head for a while. And I'd love to talk to you a little bit and understand a bit more about, particularly within your business, when you're running your business, how do you identify people who are going to be those rare creatures who both have ideas and then execute them, who bring them to life?
Yeah, I love this question. So look, I quit my job in 2017 and was sort of toying around with what business. And I, you know, had a few things sort of on the go. Didn't really get a proper client until 2018. So call it what, 7 years? And, you know, 6 months of those before of just doing a basic reconnaissance. But the amount of people that I speak to saying, oh, I've got this idea. And then I'm like, yeah, cool. All right, go run with it. Then when you see them, they've either got a new idea or they've abandoned it. So I also think that this stamina for a lot of people just isn't there. They get bored. One really large indicator for me is when Christmas starts to roll around the corner, you start to see your real hardcore dedicated entrepreneurs who are still out here doing stuff right up until Christmas Day, because that is the reality. This business doesn't stop. People are going to keep calling you, etc. What I often see is that, you know, I'm of this theory that when the going gets tough, the tough get going. So towards the end of the year, when people start to feel wrung out and tired, and I get that, I'm a human being, but I will say that that is when you start to see the people that have got these ideas really just fall off because, hey, they don't want to sit at home and work on their idea. They want to go to the Christmas party that someone invited them to. Or, hey, I don't want to feel like getting up early because I'm tired and I've got a hangover today. So these are the things that I see are ingredients that people forego because they want to have a better lifestyle, perhaps. And for me, that is not what's going to get an idea to execution. So I always say to people, look, I'm a big advocate for startups and people trying to, you know, do something because I do it myself.
How do you maintain that motivation? You know, you've faced enormous challenges and, you know, you even said yourself, like it's 7 years you've been doing this. That's a long time to keep it going. How do you keep that motivation up?
Well, I think it's probably in my DNA. So I think a lot of the things that I do, I can't control it. It's just the way I'm wired. So I think that that's probably an advantage. I would also say that, you know, Rome wasn't built in a day. No one became successful overnight. And I think that unfortunately in the era of social media, there's a lot of people, you know, pushing to say, oh, you know, I did this course and then I became a millionaire and I fly around the private jet. I think that that is fabricated. And I think that you really do need to do the work. I've also learned from people like Alex Hormozi that's out here saying, you know, your first 5 years of entrepreneurship, you're just toying around and finding what's going to work. It probably takes a good 10, 15 years to build something substantial. And I actually knew that going in. I've done a lot of research. Also, I'm from a bit more of an entrepreneurial background in terms of my family. So I think that I understand that that was the game. And I knew that I just really had to be consistent, work hard, show up, do the right thing. And eventually that I get there. And I'm really of the theory that if you if you want to chop a tree down, you're just going to have to do it bit by bit. It's just not going to happen in the one hit. So I think once you're in that mindset from the get-go, you start to realize that it is going to take time. So for me, my motivation is always going to be, hey, I'm not like everyone else, so I'm not going to operate like everyone else. I'm going to be the first one here. I'm going to be the last one to go. I'm going to be the person leading up to Christmas that may have to forgo Christmas parties. And I'm actually okay with it because this is the path that I chose to do, which means that I have to sacrifice at some point. You can't have it all the time. So I've always really wanted this. Even when I was a kid, I always wanted my own business. So I've always in my heart and soul really wanted to do something like this. And I'm prepared to get in here and do the work and roll my sleeves up. I'm not afraid of hard working. I'm not afraid of challenges. But I have my days too where sometimes it does appear hard. But then I know that a new day will start and it starts again. But having that mindset has definitely gotten better in the last few years. When I started, Jen, I definitely wasn't this resilient. But equally, I was a lot younger back then. So I think that now I've got a good momentum going. And I think that it's going to be very, very hard for me to slow that down.
Yeah, I think that's fantastic. And there's a lot to unpack from that. A couple of places that I want to go with that. And the first one is, can you talk a bit more about, you mentioned, I guess, a couple of times. So firstly, your family having that slightly more entrepreneurial bent and kind of how that set you up from a young age to want to do something like this?
Yeah, so my grandparents, well, grandparents, great-grandparents that sort of change on both sides, migrated to Australia. So my dad's side is Irish that migrated to do like cane farming, and my mum's Italian. So again, they migrated here as well to do cane farming. Hence the reason why I was brought up in Queensland, because I come from a farmer's background effectively. And one of the things where they had to get internationals in because they couldn't find people in Australia to do the work. So I've also probably had it engendered into me at a young age to not be afraid to do the hard work, to not be afraid to do what other people don't want to do. And then sort of, you know, my parents sort of did various other careers from that. But I would say as well, like even when I wanted to go out on my own, my parents weren't sitting there saying, no, you can't do it. They were like, hey, how can we support you? And they're like, you know, if you were a horse that we could bet on, like we'd back you. And I think that that does make a significant difference because I've also come across people over the years and they don't have that backing. So I think that, again, when I started this, I was 25 years old, which really seems young when I'm almost sitting here talking to you at almost 33 years old. I think, gosh, I can't believe I had that level of naivety, which is great because it's helped me power on with some of the problems that I've encountered over the time. So there's various reasons to that. But again, I think it's been drummed into me as a kid. And I've really taken forward that hard work ethic to never, ever give up. And I won't. And I haven't. And there have been times where I could easily have given up. So I think that I've been lucky in that respect and other people perhaps haven't been.
Yeah, I think you say lucky, and I am not from a farming background, but I did grow up in a village, so we were surrounded by them, is, you know, it does not stop. It never stops. And so I think that's a really interesting, you know, background to come from. If you're going to have this entrepreneurial mindset is, you know, from a farming perspective, it's also about understanding this greater goal. You know, nature is in charge, or the seasons are in charge, or, you know, the crop is in charge, or you have to harvest. And I think from that entrepreneurial mindset, it's you've got a goal in place. You know, you're excited by the next product or the next storytelling opportunity or the next big story to break or the next big advance in cybersecurity. You know, and that seasonality also plays into it, I think.
Yeah, exactly. And like I said, it's showing up each day. It's bit by bit, Kaizen theory, just 1% better each time, challenging myself. I didn't have a lot of these skill sets when I first started out. I built it and grew it. And I knew that I wanted to be best in the business. So to be best in the business is showing up, foregoing other opportunities. Now, I know that's not what people want to hear, but this is the reality of what it takes. If you really want to do this and you want to do it well, you will have to sacrifice. So I think that all of these people on Instagram claiming they're doing this, they're living out of Bali and all that, I don't know if they're really running a capability. But again, I think that in my experience, I'm friends with a lot of entrepreneurs who've built really successful businesses. We share very common parlance on that front.
Yeah, I think from the, it's very interesting, the social media perspective, you know, there's almost that divide again, isn't there, when we talk about the storytelling, you know, there's social media as in, you know, very much perceived as these people who are going around saying, you know, I'm only doing a little bit of work and it's all very easy and it looks very glamorous. And then there's the media who are telling important stories and, you know, bringing really important information to bear. I actually find it fascinating that there is some, but that there isn't more conversation around the back end of that social media side of it. You know, there are many people out there like influencers who start out really small. And you mentioned Mr. Beast earlier, and he's a great example. You know, this isn't someone who's sitting around the pool. You know, this is someone the same as you. This is the grind 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. It's not easy. You know, really, if you want to make something big out of it and you want to be a driver in the new media world, it absolutely isn't a game of glamour, you know?
Look, exactly. And, you know, I listened to an interview that someone interviewed him on recently, and he is such a phenomenal young man because he was talking and I'm like, oh my gosh, that sounds like me. Because he's like, oh, you know, sometimes I'm getting tags and, you know, he does these crazy videos and he's got to fly everywhere around the world. He's like, but then I sit back and go, well, I'm at this level because no one else is willing to do that. And so sometimes people say, KB, you're crazy. And I'm like, yeah, but they're like, how do you do it all? I'm like, because I've chosen to do that. So yes, I have to put up with some of the consequences of that. But then equally, I think that no one else wants to do it either. So it makes sense. And then when I'm hearing, you know, Mr. Beast sort of talking, like it felt like me, the male version of me as he's speaking. And I think that really is what's testament to getting these, to being successful and to growing a business. And I think that, you know, this is why sometimes I see past a lot of these people on social media. And it's like, you've been an entrepreneur for 5 seconds. Like, you really need to do the time and you've really got to get runs on the board and earn your stripes before I think people will really listen to you. And I even just knew it's going to take time. I thought to myself, it's going to take 10 years before I start to see any real dividends.
Yeah, I love the attitude. And you raise there a really interesting point about, you know, thriving in different environments. And you did come up in a traditionally male environment, you know, within cybersecurity. Can you talk to us a little bit about how you have evolved your style and the way you present yourself in order to thrive in those environments?
Yeah, and this would probably go into some of the challenges that I've had. And I think I shared this at the Flip the Focus event. Maybe I didn't, but I'll say it here. When I was younger, I've always loved fashion. So for me, that's a way in which I can demonstrate my personality, which is described as eccentric and out there. So I think my fashion style maybe...
Your fashion style is spectacular. And we did mention it earlier. My daughter and I are absolutely besotted with your newspaper print pants, which we see in your online content. It's absolutely spectacular.
Oh, well, thanks, Jen. And I think that when I was working in, you know, more enterprises in a traditional setting, I was really heavily ridiculed and criticized. And, you know, there was even a lady that sort of came up to me and said, oh, instead of reporting, can you focus on fashion reporting? And she said it publicly. So about 20 people in the office overheard. And I was working in large enterprise, right? So there wasn't just like three people. There was a lot of people. So she humiliated me. And so from that moment, I thought I could listen to this woman and quit, or I just water for ducks back and I keep going. And I'm glad that I chose the path of to keep going, because she wasn't even a male and she was a female talking to me like that. I thought, well, there's an opportunity here. If you go back and look through, I mean, look with, you know, even the work that you guys are doing at Hotwire, you understand that when you are different and you stand apart from everyone else, that's a real opportunity to overtake and to path your own way. So obviously there's this stereotype of what a technology security person wears or what they look like. And clearly it's not me. But then equally, I thought it's created an opportunity that I'm going to be able to juxtaposition the industry by being myself, which is easy to be. And then secondly, it's going to give the industry something different.
Yeah, I love that. And I think it's such an interesting conversation to have. And for as we're in a largely audio medium, we should point out a few times I have met KB in person, she is always fabulously dressed and it's always very striking. You can see KB from a distance, you know it's her, incredibly polished, incredibly stylish. This is the defining moment where someone's saying to me like, oh, I can't look amazing and be really interested in fashion and also work in cybersecurity. Because even saying that sentence out loud now, it just sounds ridiculous. It's so reductive, but it's absolutely, those are absolutely the type of stereotypes that people operate under. And it's quite frustrating.
There's always going to be some person that's like that. But I think that's when the resilience, and it is instances like this, Jen, where you build that stamina against those people. And now it doesn't really bother me. So I think that it's good, because now that if I'm at 33 almost, and I'm getting upset by stuff like that, it's going to slow me down in what I'm going to do. So it's actually good that these sort of things happen when I was younger, because it, man, it's built a really strong backbone for me to just keep, you know, keep moving on.
Yeah, I think so. And you're absolutely right. You know, we talked about it earlier on. We've now got people, my daughter's age, she's a teenager. You know, she is, they've kind of completely, you know, leapfrogged over the next generation. Her expectation, you know, when she saw your outfit, which was really flamboyant and stylish and amazing when you're interviewing people about cybersecurity, she didn't, like, that wasn't what was weird to her. She just said, oh, you know, that's so cool. She wasn't like, oh, it's cool. And it's weird that she's talking about cybersecurity. That didn't really cross her mind. And I do love that for the next generation that already, you know, hopefully some of this we have skipped over and, you know, got, you know, Lord above, actually women can be more than just the one thing. Like, you not just well-dressed or smart, like you get to be both. It's interesting to talk about how you have kind of overcome those moments that you've had that have been really, really tough. And, you know, you talked earlier about you've had some, you know, there are individual moments that stand out, but also prolonged moments that, you know, are very difficult when you're building your own business. What do you do, KB, to build your mental resilience, particularly if you think that you're working, you know, both in media and in tech? They're kind of the two probably fastest paced change industries going on at the moment. How do you keep so mentally resilient?
Yeah, it's interesting, because as you grow and your business grows and as your workload grows, it's hard. I would say at the end of last year, I was doing a lot of travel events. It's very hard going on your body, your mental and emotional, etc. I think by the end of the year, I was definitely pretty tired. So when I look back at that time at the end of the year, I noticed that I need to change the way in which I do things, or else it's not going to be good for me, if I'm being very honest with you. So I think for me, sort of the approach that I've adopted for the year is I'm always going to get back to people. So even if it means that I don't get back to them exactly on their timeline, I will get back to people. I also think that as well, that I know a lot of people out there on social media do these big morning routines. I don't do that. I get up straight away. I start working. Then I'll sort of get ready. Or if I need to run into the office or city or whatever I need to do, then of course I'll do that. But when I'm at home, like, I don't sort of ponder out the window for 20 minutes. I really just like to get on with it. So I think that that's sort of helped my mental resiliency, knowing that I can get through this work and then therefore I don't feel so overwhelmed and stressed. Because I think for me personally, being overwhelmed and stressed is what challenges that resiliency. Like I said, I like to be organized on top of it. Being organized, I think, is something that has my mom is incredibly organized. So I think I've got that from her. But I've noticed as well, when I'm working with certain people, they're probably not as organized. So I think that is a testament to saying that's what keeps my mental resiliency. Fine, when people start losing control is because they become very disorganized and they can't organize themselves out of a paper bag. So I think at a very basic level, organizational skills, I do think not enough people have them, and I am shocked by that. But because I work with so many different people now, I am seeing that is the gap. So I would say that if you know exactly what you're going to do for the day, and you're pretty tight on your guardrails, I think that keeps me personally keeping my head above the water.
Yeah, I love those. A couple of things to take out of that. Organization, I also think, is a vastly underrated skill. And these days we're very lucky, because even if you don't have it yourself, you can outsource it. You know, there are amazing AI products that will help you outsource things and stay organized. And the second thing that I thought was super interesting that you said again is just really making sure you're keeping communication open, because I think one tendency can be when people get very busy and they kind of feel overwhelmed is to shut down and go inward.
The other thing is, I always say this to my team, the ball should never be in our court. If someone's following us up, we're not doing our jobs here. And, you know, it's a good thing that people are calling me and wanting to do stuff with us. It means what we're doing works, right? So I can't be offended when someone's contacting me. And then I trust my team because I've very much fostered that as a very key attributes that we have with PRs, with our clients, with people that we're dealing with as well, to always go back and to go back first before anyone's chasing us up.
Yeah, I love that. I think that's a really beautiful tip. You know, like if the ball is in your court, you're doing it wrong, I think is fantastic. And it also, as well as respect and trust, it also feels very much like a team. You know, if you're not having to chase someone up for something, you feel like you're all in it together. And then that's a nice person to work with. That's a team you want to be part of, you know, and you're engaged in.
Yeah, and equally, and it's not like this is a theory of mine, but I've just seen over time, like people are more willing to go out of their way because they know that I go out of my way for them. And then equally, I get the same level of reciprocity from people. And so now when people need, when I'm asking, oh, I need this really, people will bend over backwards now, but then equally they know that I've done the right thing from then. So I think respect, that does need to be taught a little bit more, perhaps in school or uni or something like that, because I respect people for what they do. Even, you know, traditional media people haven't respected PRs in the past, and I'm not of that belief. And it's nothing but PR and public relations professionals that have actually given us amazing opportunities that we've achieved. So without that, we wouldn't have had that. But equally, it's about a two-way street, and it's about giving people the respect at the end of the day. So I think that that's something that I do see is missing across all the industries.
Yeah, I'd agree. I'd agree with that. I think, you know, oh, wow, if we had our time over, hey, and we could write the curriculum, we'd be getting into some different stuff. I'd have like modules in there for tax as well, like less playing the descant recorder and more respect and how to fill your tax return in.
Exactly. So I think that's just my philosophy, and I think it works for me. And I think perhaps I've got quite old school traditional values, and maybe because I come from a country town, I feel I've got those country values that perhaps are missed in larger cities.
Yeah, I'll buy that. Same, you know, when you grow up in a village, it's a country town vibe, right? Someone's always going to see if you're not doing the right thing. So it's much easier to learn just to do the right thing.
Absolutely.
Now, speaking of our amazing wisdom, as you will know, KB, we ask our guests on Flip the Focus the same three questions to round out each interview. And so what I would love to hear from you is, what advice would you give women who are looking to get into tech right now?
Well, I think there's a couple of things to that. Number one, start understanding the tech game. Come up with your own theories of what you think works. I think stay away from more traditional mechanisms. You don't need to have a 7-year degree to work in the field. I think that the more knowledge that you have in your eagerness to want to learn really helps. I think that the whole talent acquisition thing's changing. People are hiring now for talent rather than a traditional piece of paper that you may have once obtained. So I think that's number one. Number two, when you're junior, it's going to be hard to get people to want to talk to you. Reach out to people and say, hey, you know, give them something that, you know, perhaps you can exchange. I'm not necessarily saying monetary, but perhaps you can give them something that it's a two-way street as well. I feel like sometimes when people are reaching out to me and I can see it's very one-sided, I don't engage. But if it's like, hey, you know, KB, I'm pretty junior, but I also know something about blah, 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 blah that I can offer in an exchange, I think that's a really good way to get your foot in the door as well, because people don't owe you anything. Exactly. And you know what? That's why I love it. It doesn't sort of stay the same. There's also so much stuff going on, and that's what really excites me. It's not the same old boring sort of thing happening, you know, the volume of it. I get an adrenaline, I get a real kick out of it.
My final question to you, KB, is what are three things that each of us could do right now that would help amplify female voices in Australian tech? Generally speaking, these are as small or as simple as, you know, somebody you think we should be following on LinkedIn, or industry events we should join, or a particular business that you love and you think that we should support?
Oh, okay. So number one would be, when someone does something on LinkedIn, genuinely be happy for them. I'm nothing but, you know, I'm not just writing a comment because I'm trying to socially engineer my way up. No, if I don't want to comment, I won't comment. If I don't want to like it, I won't. So I'm coming from a very genuine perspective. So I don't see enough of that happening. That's the way in which we can support other women in this space. I think the second thing is as well, like, it's hard in security. There are obviously less women, but I'd love to obviously interview a lot more women, and they don't have to be the VP of so-and-so and so, but they may have a really good story or a really good angle, even if it's super technical, that I haven't covered before that I think would profile them on our show. And then I think perhaps lastly, that there are specific industry events that people should attend, and maybe you should approach someone that you don't know and say, hey, I don't really know you, but would you like to go to this? Because when you've got someone there, you don't feel as awkward. It's very hard going to events you don't know people. I still feel awkward going to things, believe it or not. So I'm just very good at hiding it.
Yeah, I think it's so often the case. That's the amazing pieces of advice. A couple of things I would pull out, like the last thing you said, I'll address that first. I find often with more junior team members as well, they'll say to me, oh, you're so confident. I'm absolutely not. It's just, I think the more you do it, the better you get at hiding it. And also you realize that everybody has a level of discomfort. When you first walk into a room and you don't see anyone you know, it's perfectly normal and natural to feel like mildly overwhelmed by it.
Absolutely. And I don't see enough of that happening. I also think I have a couple of fallback questions. Something when I used to go to a lot of industry events when I was building my brand, probably 2016, 2015 days, I was like, hey, what brought you to the event? Number one, hey, what did you think of the keynote speaker? So I think really challenge yourself. Just go up and ask someone. They're not going to, they're at the same event as you are. So they're the same type of caliber of person. So it's not like they're going to beat you down and get up you before why you ask them a question. Most people are more receptive. But I think if you make the play first, people will respond.
Yeah, I absolutely agree. And the last thing I wanted to come back to you on, which I love that you said in terms of advice, is like saying no to the scarcity mindset, you know, and you've actually said a number of different things in our time together today, which really play back to that. There is room for everybody to be successful. You know, go out, if you have a cool idea in a weird niche, go and follow it, you know, execute it, make it come to life. Invite other people on your podcast, celebrate other people, go on their LinkedIn and genuinely be excited for them. One of the amazing things about tech is it's always growing, it's always evolving, and that means there is room for everybody. Like the scarcity mindset is so not a thing within the tech space.
Exactly. And that's just how that's how I've always been. So I'm going to stay true to that, and I'm going to keep doing it. And I want to see different disruptors out there, you know, making noise and getting people upset, because that's what evolves our society. So I'm all for it. I love a bit of competition, and I think that we need more of it. So I'm here to back that from people. So I think it's great.
I love that. And that feels like a fantastic place to end our interview. You know, make noise, go out, disrupt and make change. And it's certainly something that you're doing, and we'll continue to watch you and engage with you doing it. KB, thank you so much for spending time with us today.
Well, thank you so much, Jen. I really appreciated being on the other side. I really appreciate you being very thoughtful, and you're very good at comprehending some of the things that I've said in our time of knowing each other. So I appreciate that. And I thank you for your time as well.
Thanks, KB.
If you enjoy the conversation with KB, please like and subscribe to Flip the Focus wherever you get your podcasts. It helps us get heard, which means we can keep getting great guests like KB on the show. Be sure to tune in next time for more unexpected tales of tech. And if you can't wait that long, you'll find great show content and BTS on Instagram @FlipTheFocusPodcast. Talk to you next time.